How will you disrupt yourself?
Welcome back to the Disrupt Yourself podcast, where we provide strategies and advice on how to climb the S-curve of learning in your professional and personal life, stepping back from who you are to slingshot into who you want to be. I'm Whitney Johnson. Before we start, if you're finding these shows useful, it would be wonderful if you were to open up your podcast app right now and leave our show a review. One or two sentences about why it's important to you is a huge help in helping us attract diverse, interesting guests for you to listen to. This week, we get fired up about the business of barbecue. Russ Wheeler is the CEO of Barbecue Guys, a retailer for all things grilling, smoking, and camping. But Russ's journey is about much more than the backyard life. He's been in the home improvement business for decades and navigated many tough decisions through the dot-com boom, bust, and dramatic evolution of retail. The lessons he's learned apply to anyone in an industry where the only thing that's guaranteed is change. Russ is always fun to talk to. I know you'll enjoy this conversation. I think I hear dogs in the background. Is that right? And what kind of dogs do you have? And what are their names?
Dogs, plural. I have five dogs, if you can believe that. We're gluttons for punishment. Kind of like with the S-curve and me continuously jump into these new roles and new S-curves. But I have three French bulldogs, Macy, Leela, and Sophie. And then we have two other dogs, a Shih Tzu and a Brussels Griffon. Mm. And they're in the other room. They're being good. The Frenchies are in there with me. So hopefully they're about to settle down right now.
When you think about who you are as a person today, what's something that you would say most shaped you?
You know, growing up in a small town and around my granddad's farm, I was always working. And it wasn't like I had to work, you know, I enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy working on the farm as much. That was always kind of a way to get re-motivated to go back to school and do well because, you know, hauling hay and working in tobacco is not exactly fun. You do that, you certainly want to go back and work on getting, you know, your education. But just from a very young age, you know, I was always doing something, whether it was at the country club, cleaning clubs, being a ball spotter in a golf tournament. Just seems like I was always had a job that I was doing because I enjoyed it.
Over the past few years, just for our listeners, Russ and I have had the opportunity to work together. Barbecue Guys was acquired by Brand Velocity Group. And so I've gotten to be his coach. And so one of the things I would love for us to do, Russ, is at one point you mapped your career as a series of S-curves. Would you walk through, when I look at it, I think there's three or four major ones from a career perspective. Will you walk through those?
So when I was, you know, fairly early in my career, in my, you call it, you know, mid-20s, I was calling on Home Depot as an account executive. And I got this opportunity to take a job with a company that's got this crazy name called Your Other Warehouse. And I was living in Atlanta, and this was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And so I was offered this opportunity to go down there in a higher level job, you know, kind of a VP / GM opportunity type role. And the folks at Home Depot that I was calling on that I become, you know, pretty good friends with, they're like, you're going to this YOW. We call it Lowe's Other Warehouse because Lowe's was the biggest customer of YOW at the time. We can't believe you're doing that. They were trying to hire me to come to Home Depot as a merchant. And so I picked up my family. We moved to Baton Rouge. I went to work for this really crazy named company, but it was such a unique business. And the guy that founded it, Tom Bromley, is still one of my, you know, best mentors. You know, he sold me on the business and we came down there because we had a really unique business model. And the business model was basically the precursor to what everything that's being sold online today for building products or decorative products. We specialized in, you know, high-end decorative plumbing, like if you're upgrading your faucets or your decorative lighting and things like that. So it was kind of the precursor to, you know, what was being sold on HomeDepot.com and Lowe's.com. So when I took the job down there, you know, reached out to my old friends at Home Depot and said, hey, you ought to come down here and see this. It's really special. They're like, we don't like it because it's Lowe's. And Lowe's was our biggest customer at the time. Well, I ended up getting them to come down and we started, you know, doing business with Home Depot, which is pretty cool. And they ended up wanting to acquire us. So Home Depot actually acquired the company that they said I should never go to join, and spent the next 5 years growing my career, you know, not just in this company that was a really unique business, but you know, growing into one of the best businesses out there. So that was probably one of the first S curves that I jumped. About 5 years after the acquisition with Home Depot, I was continuing to get in areas of increasing responsibility. You know, when we acquired about $150 million, we built it up to about $750, almost $1 billion, doing all the special orders at Home Depot, as well as kind of, like I said, that when this is when .com was just starting, and doing all those kind of shipments, great service, and then shipping directly to the customer's home. And so that was a great experience, and I was really enjoying it, but it was more of a matrixed organization, if you know what I mean. And so I was a GM over a large business, but I didn't have complete control of all parts of that function. And so I was approached about...
Wait, before you go on, just to clarify for people, because not everybody will know what a matrix organization is. So are you saying because it was matrix, because you had different people you were reporting into, you were managing one part of the business, but not the entire part? So just talk through that really briefly for people.
That's 100% correct. So okay. You figure when we were acquired, obviously we ran the whole business, mm-hmm. you know, from logistics, customer service, marketing. When we were acquired by Home Depot, Home Depot was going to run a lot of the logistics. So there was different functional areas that were being handled by different people, and you would have a peer that you worked with. I was in charge of the overall sales, marketing, and profitability, mm-hmm. but I didn't have 100% control of all those different functional areas because, mm-hmm. again, it was matrixed out to these different business units as part of a big company.
So you did that. You're doing this for about 5 years. You're growing the business from, you said, $250 million to almost $1 billion. You get to the top of your S curve. And then what do you do?
So again, I could have had a great career. I mean, I was having a great career at Home Depot. I could have continued to grow, you know, as an officer in the company and moving through the organization. But I saw an opportunity, or I was approached about an opportunity to go to a company called Hans Grohe, which is a German faucet and shower company. And it was going to give me full autonomy, international, as well as manufacturing experience. And it was something that really looked exciting to me. Now, this is a much smaller company. It was in the, when I joined, it was in that, you know, $70 to $80 million range. And so joining Hans Grohe was, everybody's like, are you crazy? You're going to this small company. And I'm like, it's an international company. I wanted to get this more, you know, global experience. And so it was really great. I got to work really closely with the Grohe family who, you know, founded the company, and Klaus, who was actually Hans Grohe's son, you know, he invented most of the things that we see in the shower today, whether it's the adjustable spray shower head or a hand shower or a wall bar. Klaus invented all that stuff. And he and his sons were involved in the business. And his youngest son worked with me in the U.S. market. So I got to kind of teach him about the U.S. market while they were teaching me about the European markets and other parts of the world. And it was just a great experience as we grew that business. It got me more international experience, spent a lot of time in Germany and Switzerland. And we were manufacturing in the U.S. And the Germans are pretty funny because, you know, they had a saying, you can have whatever finish you want as long as it's chrome. Because, you know, if you look at the European styles, it's still very contemporary. Everything's chrome. But in the U.S. markets, you know, people like gold finishes, oil rub bronze, stainless steel, satin nickel. So there's all these different finishes that were needed for the U.S. market that was completely different. We're like, hey, we want to sell this very modern, cool brand, but we also have to adapt it to the local market as well. And so because of my relationship with the Grohe's, they kind of gave us a lot. They gave me a lot of leeway. We had U.S. manufacturing. We were doing injection molding. So we're injection molding our shower heads. We had a plating operation, which is a very complex, you know, heavy metals, very dangerous. You have to have good safety protocols. And then we were making all these different finishes in these PVD chambers where you're actually putting the finishes onto the products.
Stop for just a second. PVD chamber?
Physical vapor deposition. The fact that I can even remember that. So this is a plating process. It's a lot cleaner than just doing like chrome plating, but you can put the color on there.
Yeah.
So you mix these gases in a chamber and you can put a finish. It's a very hard, scratch resistant finish. So when you see something that is oil rub bronze or satin nickel or, you know, stainless steel, it's probably PVD. It was a really high tech operation using a lot of the, you know, German engineers coming over and teaching the Americans. But one of the things that was the most cool thing about it is, you know, we were still globally sourced. We were buying from our plants in Germany, plants in France, US, we were manufacturing stuff. Obviously, we had a plant in China. We were importing components from there as well. But we actually started exporting to China. So that was something that was super cool because, you know, we feel like everything always just comes from China to the US market with a global supply chain. But we were actually sending products to China because, again, the Chinese market, the Middle East, they like a lot of gold. You know, it's a feel, you know, it gives them the sense of wealth. And so we were actually exporting these gold faucets that we were sending to the Middle East for big projects like in Dubai, like the Burj Khalifa, that big giant, the tallest building in the world in Dubai. We did all the faucets in there with this gold finish. We were doing a lot of big projects in Shanghai and Beijing. So it was pretty cool to not just manufacture for the U.S. market, but actually export it to these other markets.
So you took this job at Hansgrohe. It gave you a lot more international experience. You were working directly with the owners. It allowed you to do manufacturing. It sounds like you had a greater sense of autonomy. So you were willing to trade a larger P&L for all of those things. And so that was your next S curve. Yes.
That was my next S curve too.
Okay.
Because again, we go from a very large company to a very small company. And one of the first things we did when I got to Hansgrohe was about 15 or 20 million of that 80 was Home Depot. And we were losing money on it. And, you know, so I knew the buyers. I mean, these were my colleagues. And I went to them and I said, guys, we're not making money on the faucets that we're selling you. You know, we need a price increase. And, you know, I could tell you Home Depot, it's a lot more fun to be negotiating on that side of the table than being a vendor partner. And they said, well, we can't do it. And so we're going to have to transition out of it. And we said, that's fine. And so we ended up transitioning out because we weren't making money. And obviously we're a for-profit company. And we actually took those products and took them to Costco. So it was another opportunity to get another sales channel. And with Costco, it was pretty interesting because Costco had never sold a higher end German design centric faucet. And when I first met the buyer and I was working with trying to build a relationship, they said, hey, look, we'll buy these 50,000 that you have for Home Depot at $99 and we'll blow them out. And I said, no, this is a $300 faucet that you can sell. These customers are in Costco. And, you know, it took some testing. We did some testing. We did some road shows and we actually proved to Lester, who was the buyer at that time, that, hey, this is a great product that will sell well. So we ended up getting it in there. We tested it. We sold it for $249, which was a great value for the customer. And Costco has very high, you know, very affluent customers coming in there. And we proved that they could do it. And within 2 years, we're doing over $30 million with Costco on one SKU, strictly just a kitchen faucet.
It completely replaced your Home Depot business. So one slight digression is I didn't realize that Costco was considered a store for affluent customers. That's really interesting.
What you see about Costco is they may not buy it at Costco, but those customers are in Costco. And we proved that a high-end brand will resonate with a customer. If you go in there, you'll see them. They'll be doing a roadshow on Vitamix. So they're selling these $500 blenders. So the customers are in there, and usually you'll create something that's just a little bit unique and exclusive for Costco that's a value. And it's almost like that treasure hunt. If you don't buy it when it's there, it might be gone. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll go in there and there'll be Tumi luggage. So they definitely sell high-end brands, but it's almost like if you have to get it when you get it or it might be gone. And so we built this up over years with Hansgrohe. We did a couple of different faucets over the years. We did a shower program 1 year that was super successful. And when I left, Kohler, Moen, Delta, everybody's in there now. So it created a whole channel, you know, based on something that we kicked off with a high-end German brand that a lot of people hadn't heard of.
I love it. All right. So how long were you at Hansgrohe? And then what was your next S curve after that?
So I was at Hansgrohe for about 8 years and again, really enjoyed it. My next step there, they wanted me to be in charge of sales and marketing for the whole business, meaning have responsibility for the world. And very similar to where I grew up in Mayfield, Kentucky, Schiltach, Germany is even smaller, if you can believe that. So this great, you know, international company that's invented all this stuff grew up in Schiltach, Germany, which is in the middle of the Black Forest So that's like Southwest Germany. So figure you're 2 hours south of Stuttgart, a couple hours north of Zurich, in the beautiful Hansel and Gretel postcard type space. But I brought my wife there a few times and it was a little too slow. Let's just say it that way. And while I would have been traveling all over the world, you know, bringing and moving the family there would have been tough. I think it would have been a great experience for our kids. But again, it would have been a lot easier if it had been Zurich or Frankfurt or Stuttgart, you know, where they have like an international school and things like that that they get onto. She'll talk is a little slow. I didn't want to put my family through that. My next S-curve was to take a lesser role at a company that I actually helped, you know, get started, which was called Build.com. And Chris Friedland, who founded Build.com, it all goes back to that Year of the Warehouse company where it was acquired by Home Depot. So when Chris was founding Build out of his apartment in Chico, California, which is where Build is, I was the first person that ever gave him credit, like in the early 2000s. So they were trying to sell faucets online through faucet.com, Faucet Direct, which eventually came Build.com. And, you know, I saw this opportunity. I said, this is where I think the future is. They're getting their money up front on a credit card. So they're floating it for 30 days. They're giving the customer a good experience. And we were doing all the fulfillment. So we were doing the, you know, packing slips and shipping everything next day air to their customers. So Chris and I go back to the point where I actually invested in him because I was betting on him and gave him credit. And then several years later, he comes back and said, hey, would love you to come join the company, because he was in the process of transitioning out because they had sold their company to Ferguson Enterprises.
Interesting. So far, every single job you've gotten has been through a solid, strong relationship network from prior.
Everyone.
That is fascinating. All right. So you go to Build.com. So talk to us in terms of, you said it was a smaller role, but a bigger company. So, and the reason I'm asking you this is people are listening. One of the things that sometimes we think about is that oftentimes when we're jumping to new S curves, when we're disrupting ourselves, we're getting something, but we're also giving something up. And we've seen that with a number of your situations where you're like, okay, bigger role, more autonomy, more responsibility, but also smaller company initially or smaller P&L initially. So when you went from Hans Grohe to Build, what was the dynamic there?
So Hans Grohe, we had tripled the sales over that time period, but it was still a relatively small company compared to some others. And when Chris reached out to me, the opportunity was, hey, he had sold the company. It was still in a very high growth pattern. It was in, you know, north of a couple $100 million. And he wanted me to come out to be COO. And I had a relationship with the Ferguson as well, because they were big customers of Hans Grohe. They wanted me, as, you know, kind to take over for Chris, because once he worked through his earnout, you know, obviously he could go and do something else. So I was brought in to kind of take over for Chris, give them some confidence that they made this investment in this acquisition and it was going to, you know, pan out, because I had relationships, great relationship with Chris and that team, saw them all grow up. And then I had a great relationship with Ferguson because they were my customer at Hans Grohe. So I joined, and there was a couple of different opportunities that we wanted to do. I wanted to get that e-commerce experience because I was seeing e-commerce was continuing to accelerate, digital plus, you know, online, buy online, offline, all those kind of things. I wanted to be more involved and learn that much better.
What year was this when you did that, when you moved to Build?
That would have been 2010. Products first started being sold online. I mean, this is almost like dial up. I mean, you would load the page and you could literally see the page slowly render as it was going down. So so now it's more high speed, but it's still not mainstream. It's absolutely not mainstream. You know, Home Depot and Lowe's are still not very good at it. Amazon is selling CDs and things like that. They're in books. They're not really selling the huge plethora of things that they sell today. So it was still fairly early on. So we still had a lot of upside and not a lot of competition. So there was a lot of green space to go after. The other opportunity they wanted me to come on and help with was to build up their private label, you know, slash own brand portfolio, because again, it's a lot more profitable. You know, the margins on plumbing and lighting are pretty good, but the margins on plumbing are not great. So my experience from Hans Grohe, understanding manufacturing, I was helping not just Build.com, but also Ferguson start to grow their private label, own brand.
What's the relationship of Ferguson to Build.com?
Ferguson acquired Build.com.
Okay. Ferguson owned Build.com. Okay. Got it. All right. So you went in as basically a COO. You were excited about this really building out e-commerce. It's a larger company. And then you eventually became the CEO of Build.com. Is that right?
I did.
Okay.
Now, first couple of years there was kind of standing up this, the new private label opportunity to, you know, build our own brands, you know, increase the margins, build out the sales center. That's the consultative sales that we do, and then transition into Chris's role. And Chris stayed on as a consultant, as an advisor for another 3 or 4 years. But, you know, then I took that over. It was in Chico, California, and I was commuting from Atlanta back and forth because, again, I didn't want to move my family out there because my kids were in, you know, middle school or high school at the time. So I was balancing the family with, you know, still having to be out there and run the company. This was pre-COVID, so you need to be in the office a little bit. And I was always big on remote work. So I'd been doing it for the last 10 years, but I was going out there and that was pretty tough, you know, flying cross country to Chico. It's a long trip. I could be in Germany about the same amount of time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's Build.com. You're eventually the CEO, and then Barbecue Guys comes along. How did you get this particular gig? Cause I'm interested in the networking piece and also the calculus that was going on in your mind of like why you know, apart from the move, but what else were you giving up and what were you getting?
If you do the right thing, it will come back to you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've always just kind of felt that way. If I could help somebody, I'd always try to help them. And then I've just been very fortunate to have these great relationships. The Ferguson executive team I was really close with. I had moved into actually a Ferguson executive role about a year prior. So I was running, you know, Build.com. I ended up taking over all the portfolio companies that we'd acquired, as well as Build.com, and more of a, you know, a senior executive role for Ferguson over all of digital commerce, which was Ferguson.com, Power Equipment Direct, Supply.com, all these companies that we had bought over the years. One in Texas that did kegerators, which was a fun space.
What?
Kegerators.
What's a kegerator?
Beer on tap. Or cold brew coffee. So it was, again, it was a company called Compact Appliance that we had bought in, Texas company. And the reason I bring that up is Rick, the founder of Compact Appliance, knew Mike Hackley, who's the founder of Barbecue Guys. So this was, call it 2 years I've been there. So probably four or five years ago, mm-hmm. I'm in this, you know, kind of portfolio role. We looked at acquiring Barbecue Guys. We met Mike and his wife, Ladina, and we looked at acquiring them as a Ferguson acquisition that would have been a bolt-on to Build.com. Mm-hmm. And again, Build.com is really good at the decorative inside the home improvement, a little bit of outdoor lighting and things, but certainly not focused on the outdoor. Ferguson has these beautiful design centers where, you know, they'll build out your bathroom or your kitchen. They sell outdoor, but they're not really focused on it. Mm-hmm. So again, it was kind of just it was adjacent, but not adjacent enough that we felt like it was, you know, an immediate need. And actually Mike, at the time he didn't want to sell anyway. Mm-hmm. So we probably could have done the deal, but we decided that, hey, we like each other. And then he decided to pull it off the market for a few years. So fast forward, I'm in this again, a more matrixed, and I don't know if that's the trigger for me, but I'm at Ferguson in a more matrixed role because I'm not running Build anymore, which is what I really enjoy doing, is running a company and really having, mm-hmm. you know, control of the company versus, you know, overseeing a lot of different P&Ls and being in a more kind of an executive leadership, working with the executive team at Ferguson and doing things, which was fun, but it's not the same thing I like to do is like really getting my hands dirty and being in the business and trying to build things. So again, relationship, Chris Friedland, who's the founder of Build, was down consulting with Mike Hackley on
the founder of Barbecue Guys.
Yep. He called me. This was during COVID. I get a call from Chris and said, hey, what would you think about coming to run Barbecue Guys? Hackley's looking at selling it, private equity. And I said, private equity is not something that I think I want to do. I'd have been approached over the years by a lot of different private equity firms, and my core values didn't really align with traditional private equity core values. And Chris was like, you really should meet Steve and BVP. They're doing it differently. There's something about these guys that are different. And I said, well, sure, I'll be happy to have a conversation. And then Chris talked to Steve, who's the founding partner of BVP. And he said, well, yeah, we're pretty far down the path on a really great candidate, but we'll have a conversation. So Steve and I spoke literally like 2 days later on that Sunday, and we spoke for several hours. And we had this great conversation, and he goes, this just seems right. And, you know, and I just said, I know, it's kind of weird. It was just very organic. And I'll tell you, it was all around our core values being very aligned. BVP was trying to create a different type of private equity model where it's not about just enriching the senior executives of the team, but doing something where actually all employees can benefit and build wealth. And so they had created something, or they were in the process of creating something that I kind of tagged onto at the very end and helped them, you know, articulate and build out, called Share the Gains. Mm. So they were giving, they go, we're going to give 10% of our carried interest, which is the what they make on a deal, to the employees, to the non-executive employees that didn't have equity in the deal. And I was like, you know, I love that. I love that idea that completely aligns with my core values of doing the right thing and giving back. I said, I want to give 10% of my equity too. And Steve was just like blown away that I just would want to do that. I'm like, well, you're doing it. I think it's a great idea. That'll just make the pool bigger, mm-hmm. you know, so we can continue to do that. So then we said, we have to figure out, you know, how do we do this? Because it's not really been done. And we were kind of, you know, operating without a playbook. So we started figuring it out. And, you know, Steve's just an incredibly good person, you know, super smart, you know, Harvard, you know, undergrad and Harvard JD, and just super, he likes to say he's a reformed lawyer, but just really smart guy and thinks of these things. We said, well, this pool of dollars could be anywhere from, you know, 50 to 100% of a year's salary for every single employee that's there prior to the acquisition. And he goes, and then on any change of ownership, then they would get that. I said, Steve, we can't pay people that are, you know, working in the warehouse or driving a forklift or doing something like that a year's salary. I said, they'll quit. You know, we'll lose a lot of people. I said, right. And we also need to kind of protect them from themselves. Mm-hmm. If we pay them out, say, let's say quarterly over 2 years, one, it'll be almost like a long-term savings program that can mm-hmm. actually help them build wealth. Mm-hmm. And it's another way for them to stay super engaged with the company. And that was, if it's a private transaction, that's the way it would trigger. And then if it was a public transaction, it would convert into shares, it vests over time. And then you have every single employee of the company has a chance to build wealth. And I saw this in action when I was at Home Depot, because, you know, over that period of time, a lot of people that they were working in stores, doing whatever, were making, you know, over time could have $1 million portfolio of Home Depot stock. So I saw it as something similar that we could do on a small scale, and then take this really great small company and try to build it into, you know, a lifestyle mm-hmm. brand.
So did you make that decision, like, after that day? Did you go home and say to your wife, I got to do this?
I was there. Again, you know, I was at that kind of that peak of that S-curve and that mm-hmm. mastery phase. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, whether you call it a glutton for punishment, I just get, you know, if I get to a certain point, I want to keep challenging myself, and my friends think I'm crazy sometimes. Mm-hmm. That's what makes me want to get up and go in the morning. So again, I loved what Steve was wanting to build mm-hmm. and with BVP, and his other partners, you know, Drew and Austin were awesome as well. Flew down, interviewed with Austin face to face, met the team. They grilled me. It was like, you know, the 10 senior leaders of the company. So again, you know, they put me through the ringer, and it was just so similar to what we did at Build. I mean, I wrote a business plan for Steve, and I said, I'm not inventing anything. I mean, we really have a great playbook that we've done over the years at Build that we can very easily, mm-hmm. you know, transition for barbecue guys. And I joke, I say, one of the most important things is just not doing the stupid things. So, you know, not stepping on those same landmines that we did over the years and say, yeah, we tried that one. That was made a mess of that one. But, you know, those are also the ones that you learn, and those are the ones that stick. So we had this great playbook of how we could, you know, take this, you know, just over $100 million business and try to build it into a, you know, potentially $500 to $1 billion business over the next few years. I was pretty psyched and excited about the opportunity, especially when we started talking about, you know, how we want to help build wealth for the employees and mm-hmm. as well as a brand.
I think what's interesting is there's a pattern for you where you go into a new situation, you're willing to step back in terms of the size of the organization or the role initially, but then over time, you're able to, as you move up that S curve, your responsibilities expand. You end up in a role that in some respects has less autonomy because you're managing across the organization. And each time you say, okay, I want more autonomy. In this case, it sounds like with Barbecue Guys, not sounds like, I know, you also got equity. So you became an owner as well. And so you're continually looking for how can I have more autonomy, have more of an impact. And so in this instance, it was not only for you personally, but also being able to share the gains with everyone inside of the company. Does that encapsulate the experience for you?
Absolutely. And yeah, for sure. I love the job opportunity, but it was absolutely an equity opportunity mm-hmm. to, hey, if we win, everybody wins. So yep. if we execute, the board, the investors win, but also all of our employees. And when I was doing the first town halls, which were all, you know, over Zoom, I very quickly started talking about when and if we would sell the company, and or if there was the opportunity, we think we have the opportunity to potentially be a public company someday if we do really well. And everybody's like, Mike just sold the company. Why are you talking about selling the company again? I said, I'm not talking about selling the company. I want to tell you why this is great for you to be part of this new family. Mm. Barbecue Guys is a family. It's you know, Mike was the reason he picked BVP and Steve is because he trusted them to protect not just his legacy of the business, but all these people that have been there, some of them 10, 15 years. So yeah. That was a big decision when he was looking for a partner. And, you know, and that's the reason he picked BVP, some of the same reason I picked him. Mm-hmm. So it was like, we want everybody to know that, hey, you are a owner in this company. If we win, you win.
So you come to Barbecue Guys, you're really excited to be here. You're an owner. It's got a great brand. It draws on all of your 20 years worth of experience. But there have been some micro curves. You have been thrown a curve or two. Talk to us about some of those that you've experienced.
You know, I've always tried to rely on data. But again, it's like if your gut is normally right, if you feel a certain thing, you're probably right. But if you can back it up with data, even better. Mm-hmm. So, you know, over the back half of 20, you know, it was still very, very heavy with COVID. Everybody's working remote, trying to run a business in a COVID environment while protecting your employees, while keeping the doors open was a lot of complexity. Plus you're a new acquiree. So you're trying to build trust, but doing it remotely. And if you are face to face, you have a mask on. And so again, it was really a crazy time to really lean in and learn. Then rolling into 21, as COVID continued to, you know, go on, everybody thought it was going to slow down. We did an acquisition. So, you know, Mike Hackley, who's the founder, is still a board member, was like, hey, there's this company that I looked at. We never got it done. I think we should do it. It's a really important part of the supply chain. So I think it was week two, we flew out to Southern California, you know, with BVP, and we had PCM, Pacific Coast Manufacturing, under LOI within a week. That was another thing about being fast and having a great private equity partner like BVP. We went really quickly. So we got them under LOI. And so we're, again, COVID, all these things going on, plus a new acquisition that's going to take time. And just to make it completely fun, because I wasn't really challenged enough, we were approached. I presented at the ICR conference, which is a lot of investors coming in there. And this was January of 21. And Steve, again, called me on a Sunday, which he likes to chat on the weekends. He's like, have you ever heard of a SPAC? And I was like, yes, I don't know much about them. I know what they are. Blank check company. He goes, well, after we presented at ICR, there's been a huge amount of interest from a lot of the banks about potentially going public. And I was like, I agree. I think we definitely have an opportunity of going public in, you know, 3 or 4 years as we, you know, start building the core foundation of the business and continue to grow it. And they were like, no, we're talking about this year. Mm. And I was
stop for just a second. So SPAC, define it for everybody.
Special purpose acquisition company, especially a blank check company.
Okay. Blank check company, but the acronym is Special Purpose Acquisition Corp. Okay. Keep going. So they're saying, we're going to do it this year. All right, go ahead.
They said, would you like to do this? Do you think it's the right thing? And uh-huh. So it was crazy to, well, first it was flattering that people liked the business. Mm-hmm. But I mean, BVP had only owned the company for about 6 months. You know, I'd been there maybe 7 or 8 months at that point, but it was something fast. The market was incredibly frothy with excitement around not just e-commerce companies, but companies that were involved in the outdoor space. So it's kind of like that perfect storm opportunity. But again, it's also a big process. And talking about new S-curve and jumping to something and learning, private equity was one, but then the whole going public process was a whole nother level. Doing these investor meetings and meeting with the different banks and lawyers and, you know, audits and all these kind of things. So it was a lot. So we all agreed as a team that we thought it was something we should go for. And we did. We went head down crazy while we're still growing, you know, well into the double, you know, large double digit growth with COVID still going on. We're also going forward with trying to take the company public via a SPAC, which is a little bit different from the traditional IPO. The SPAC is already a public company, and then you're just merging with it at the end when you close. So we started going down the path with that very aggressively. It was going really well. Tons of excitement and interest from all the investors that we were presenting to doing our roadshow. And pretty early on, March or April, I started saying supply chain is not great. Mm-hmm. There's continued challenges with the supply chain. We're fighting through it, but it's not good. This was in March of 21. Well, when you got to the summer of 21, it wasn't just like, well, we're hearing this from Russ, you know, the investors and the banks and everybody were hearing it from everybody. Then it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal every day. It was on CNBC. It just kept compounding. You know, it was like that bullwhip effect of, you know, everybody stopped, then everybody started, then everybody pushed all this demand into the market. And then obviously the, you know, mainly coming from Asia, couldn't produce fast enough. So the log jams just kept moving from Asia to Long Beach. And then, you know, it was just, you know, taking a lot longer to get your product. So it was a lot of moving pieces and parts. And heading into, you know, Q3 and Q4 of 21, again, being drilled on, you have to be accurate. You have to hit your numbers. You have to have a 3-year forecast. You have to not just hit your expectations as the analysts want to see, but beat your expectations. And so I started pushing back saying, look, there is a lot of uncertainty with this market, not just because of COVID, but there's a lot of uncertainty because of the supply chain, the inflationary costs, all the stuff that we're living in right now and early in 22 with everything that's going on was just kind of compounding those issues. So we got to the, you know, pretty close to the finish line. And, you know, I said, it's not right. It's not the right time to do it. And a lot of our peers or adjacent companies did go public in this time frame. Solo Stove, Weber, who's one of their largest customers, Traeger, same thing. They did go public in this very challenging market. And they were about a month or two ahead of when we were going to potentially close. And I'm happy to say, or I'm not happy, it was a tough year, but I'm glad we did not go into the public markets mm-hmm. with all the things that are going on right now, because it's been a challenge to say the least.
So Russ, let's stop there for a second, because I think this is really important. You're about to go public. You've spent 6 to 8 months, everybody working incredibly hard toward this goal. You've got bankers, you've got lawyers, you've got your private equity firm, you've got high profile investors, but then you say, we need to not do this. How was that for you? Like, that to me takes a lot of courage and a willingness to say, this is not the right decision for us to proceed right now. And I think so often that is very difficult to do. So talk to us a little bit about that process that you went through to be able to do that and how you felt.
For me to be the one that says, stop, it's not right, we need to pause. It was really hard. And I didn't know if I was making the right decision. Mm. I was like, am I being too risk averse? I don't feel like I am, but I'm really glad that I did in hindsight, because it would have been really tough on the company, on me personally, on our board, you know, being in the public market. So it was a challenge. And then when we got to that point and I went to the board and to Steve specifically before we went to the board, he goes, I agree, it's the right thing. Let's take a step back and reevaluate. And, you know, when we did, you know, agree to mutually dissolve with our SPAC partner, who was a great partner, by the way, a lot of these SPAC deals started unraveling, being canceled out after we did it. So I'm not saying we were the catalyst for it. I think everybody's probably looking at the same challenges we were seeing, but I'm glad that we were kind of ahead of that and not looking like that. We were just kind of, you know, jumping on that same trend.
Yeah. And I think for me, as I observe, one thing that it's important is that yes, in hindsight, it did turn out to be a good decision. But I still think that for you, and I think for a leader generally, you made the decision that at the time felt like it was the right decision. In other words, you said, here's what I think we need to do, and you did it. And so even if the outcome hadn't been what you thought it was going to be, which in this case was not, you know, things did not go well with the market, it still took a little bit of courage to make a decision that you felt like was the right decision to make at the time, right?
Absolutely. There was a lot of anxiety before, after, during. Because again, you're balancing, is it the anxiety of the market? Mm-hmm. Is it like the company's not physically ready? And how do you balance that? But again, once I had made that decision, you know, with advice from lots of different people, you included, I said, that's the decision. That's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And this is the right decision for the company. We're going to commit to it, just like we committed to going for it and going mm-hmm. through the process. And we all agreed as a team that we were going to go for it. We were all head down and running in the same direction. So I think it's always good to have your team involved to really beat things up and then get to it. And again, you debate and have healthy conflict. But then when you get to the decision, everybody runs in the same direction. I still think we are a great candidate of being a public company via the traditional path IPO, you know, sometime in the near future. And I can tell you there's still a ton of interest because the banks still, you know, call and ask for a point. You know, they're all reaching out. Let us know when you're ready. Uh-huh. Because so the interest is still there. And that was also a good feeling as well that, hey, the investors really like the business because it's a great business.
Yeah. Even as you're making this decision, your numbers are still really good and your numbers are up. And so I think that's an important thing to consider. Question for you on supply chain. As a consequence of it being so slow, is there something that you have, you know, I talk a lot about how a constraint can become a tool of creation. Is there something that you've innovated around from a process, from people, whatever it might be, as a consequence of the supply chain issues that you've had? Does anything come to mind?
Everything. It touched every part of the business. Mm-hmm. And we were very fortunate because we don't have any of these large mass merchant partners like a Home Depot or a Lowe's or a Costco mm-hmm. or Walmart or Amazon, because those are much harder to push price increases onto the market. Because we're vertically integrated as an online retailer, mm-hmm. selling our own brands, you know, we were able to pass on these price increases to the market. I mean, we saw inflationary raw material prices have gone up on stainless steel, call it 10 to 12%. Mm-hmm. Freight went up 5X, and this was widely, you know, circulated on the news that containers that you're paying $5,000 for got as high as $30,000 mm-hmm. late in Q4, which is unheard of. Mm-hmm. Seeing a little bit of normalization, but it's still well north of $10,000 to $15,000 per container. So all these costs were hitting the market. And it's like, how do you manage through this? And, you know, the market will bear what the market will bear. And again, if you start pricing yourself out of market, then you're going to slow your growth and everything else. So again, because we didn't have these contracts or anything with the big companies like Home Depot, et cetera, we were able to put them on directly to the customer. And so far, because we are selling a higher end product, mm-hmm. I mean, over half our business is outdoor kitchens. So they're, I would say they're a little bit less price sensitive. So we were able to pass it on to the market, and we're still seeing in 22 more price increases.
We've talked a lot about your own S-curve and your growth. Can you talk briefly about an instance where you've applied it to your team, where you've said to yourself, oh, I now understand how to help think about developing this person, or how to recruit this person, or, oh, it's time for this person to go work at another organization because they've done as much as they can do on this particular S curve that they're on. Does anything come to mind that obviously you can disclose publicly that would be useful for people to learn?
Absolutely. So when I really understood and started learning what the S curve was and how you can apply it, is we had everybody kind of self-rate themselves. Where are you on the S-curve? Are you at the launch point? Are you in the sweet spot? Or are you in mastery? So it was really interesting to see where people thought they were, mm-hmm. then where I thought they were. And then you really start to identify your kind of your core and extended leadership team of who's in what position and how can you leverage them. Are they in mastery? So how do you give them additional responsibility that's going to challenge them? Or again, that it could get them back to a new launch point, maybe in a new role in the organization. Or, you know, like you said, maybe they need to move on to a new organization, which is what I did in a lot of my roles. Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting to identify where everybody was. Again, we brought in some really, really smart, talented people. We brought in some super smart people from great companies like Wayfair, Sherwin-Williams. Their S-curve is they're back at that launch point, but they're bringing in a lot of external knowledge as well. Mm-hmm. So we have a great blend of a nice chunk in that sweet spot, a few that are in the mastery that we've given additional responsibility on, a few that we've moved on, and then again, some of the new folks that have joined that are bringing a lot of external knowledge in that launch point, whether it's from a digital commerce point of view, whether it's from a branding, whether it's from a product development.
I think I've heard you say that you've hired a group of people who are at the launch point of their career in your sales organization who are just really doing a phenomenal job. So I'd love for you just to talk briefly about the power of bringing in people who are fresh and new at the launch point of their career.
Following the build playbook that we built up over the years was, you know, we're an online company and we have a great digital online experience, but we're also selling a complex product. If you're designing and building an outdoor kitchen, it's no different if you're doing a custom shower or you're remodeling your kitchen. So we took that same model and we're quick to say we have a sales center, not a call center. Mm. This is not, you know, you're going, calling in, you're holding for 15 minutes, you're getting passed around. You know, when we want you to engage with one of our, whether it's customer service or salespeople, because again, we've invested in these people and we want to give a great experience, whether you're upgrading your grill or you're doing a $30,000 outdoor kitchen remodel. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways we've done that is, again, I've always had and this wasn't mine. I think it might've been Nardelli when I was at Home Depot. It's like hire athletes and teach them the sport. Mm. So again, when I joined the company, our person that was in charge of the sales center, call center then, said, oh, we can't get college kids. They wouldn't do this job. And I said, yes, they will. This is a great opportunity for them to come in and actually learn the business. There's no better way of learning the business than getting live fire and being on with customers and understanding what the challenges are. So I had a lot of these kids that were growing up that I watched grow up around here that went to, you know, whether it's Georgia Tech, Clemson, Auburn, Alabama, Florida State. And I saw them growing up. I said, these would be great kids to get at that very start of their career, mm-hmm. let them come in, learn the business, and then grow them through with barbecue guys, or they would get great experience, then go on to their next role as mm-hmm. they're doing it. But it was really fun to watch these kids that I watched grew up that I didn't even have to interview them. I knew they would be good. Mm-hmm. We've hired several for sales, a couple for finance. It's really great bringing these people in that have never had a job. One interned for us, and then we just hired him. So I caught him when he was actually in his mm-hmm. last year of college, brought him as an intern in finance, mm-hmm. and now he's a pricing analyst for us. So mm-hmm. again, bringing them in at the launch point of their career, watching them grow, and then seeing where it goes from there. But it's something that's been, you know, really exciting. And one of the things I've talked to him about is the last, call it, two classes coming out of college, most of them have never worked in an office. Mm-hmm. It's been 100% remote. It's been 100% COVID impacted. So we've got our office in Louisiana. We've got an office in Southern California with PCM. And then we're opening an office and a design center in Atlanta in Alpharetta. And so the team, I've told them, I said, look, we want that work-life balance. We want to allow you to have that flexibility. But I think we're also, we're still missing a lot by not getting together face-to-face to collaborate, train, build relationships. So we're going to kind of have that flex space, whether it's in the West Coast, whether it's in Baton Rouge, or whether it's in the Atlanta metro area, where we can get together, collaborate, still do those things that, like I said, all these young kids coming out of college, they don't know what it's like to work in an office.
Yeah.
They don't, I mean, they're working in their basement or in their apartment, and there's a lot lost there. I mean, there really is. I mean, we've proven that we can train, people can be successful remotely, but we've had a few meetings, you know, when COVID started to loosen up. And I told the team, I said, I never thought I'd be happy and excited about sitting in a Marriott conference room for 2 days eating crap food. Uh-huh. And just by being face to face with the team and collaborating, it's been super, super exciting.
You've talked about your core values a couple of times. Can you speak to that, please?
when I talk about our core values, it's about doing the right thing, giving back. It could be volunteering, or it could be, you know, doing the right thing with your team, meaning the things we talk about with share the gains and things like that. And it's, I also say it's really easy to do the right thing when it's aligned and you're being successful. It's harder to do the right things when it's a tough market. And I'll tell you again, typical private equity would be incredibly tight on things like this. And I mean, an example, we had a hurricane last year. We had a lot of people that were impacted and flooded. And very quickly, BVP said, we want to help the people. And we want to help the people too. So they paid out of their pocket. You know, we gave every single employee like $500. We're also building a Barbecue Guys Foundation to have that pool of dollars there to again, not just help out our own Barbecue Guys family whenever there's something that's happened that's been impacted, but also to use that as our mechanism to give to the community, whether it's to partners, like I was telling you, Operation Barbecue Relief, or protecting the wetlands, because we are in Louisiana. There's a lot of erosion there, and feeding the hungry. So all of our kind of service related partners are tied around our core values as a business and our core value as people. And again, we really look hard at that when we're hiring new people. Anybody that gets to meet at the interview stage is going to have the technical skills. So then it's how close are you on a culture fit? And one of the biggest cultural fits are, do you share the same core values? And when they hit on that, it's almost a guarantee that that person's going to be a pick for me. Because again, once they get to me, they're going to have the technical skills.
Our latest book, Smart Growth, is grow yourself to grow your people to grow your company. And so what are you doing to grow yourself right now?
Well, I'm using an executive coach who's wonderful. It's
Thank
Whitney,
you.
By the way. It's an investment in yourself. And again, having that sounding board is incredibly beneficial for me personally. And this is not a, you know, a plug for Whitney. I mean, this is again something that BVP said, we're not just hiring you, but we want to help grow you as well. And this mm-hmm. is a program that was driven by BVP as well, which is another great experience. Mm-hmm. And similar to what I'm doing with my coaching with you, and you know, is we are expanding what we're calling share the gains to share the growth, mm-hmm. where we want to do some extended coaching for mm-hmm. you know, our team, and to continue to invest in them. Because again, we want them to understand where they are on that S curve. But it's really about buying in people that want to grow.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be seen as, oh, here's more work that I have to do this. If that's the way they feel, they're not the right person for it.
All right. So, you know, this question that I'm about to ask, because I ask it of you frequently, which is, as we've been talking today and you've been processing, are there any connections or insights that you've had, or just generally what was useful to you as we're talking?
Well, you know, it's kind of taking that trip down memory lane, you know, all the way back was really kind of interesting. Specifically, as we kind of got more in detail, it's, you know, like I said, I'm kind of a glutton for punishment sometimes. And, you know, my friends that have stayed with the same in a kind of a similar role for a long time in their career, they're like, why do you keep doing this? And I said, you know, I don't know. It excites me. It's what I enjoy doing. It's building, but it's, you know, only been at Barbecue Guys really, I'm, you know, a few months from 2 years, and it feels like dog years since I have these dogs, but it's been good. I mean, we've accomplished a lot in an incredibly crazy environment. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've probably learned more in the last 2 years than I've learned in the last 20. Mm-hmm. And it's always that way whenever I make one of these S curve launches, and I just like to learn. And so again, while it's been a lot, it's been 24/7 for a long time, it's enjoyable. And I love learning and growing and taking on new challenges and then having great teams that help you solve them.
Mm. Russ, thank you so much for being with us. This has been a lot of fun.
Glad to be here, Whitney. Always enjoy talking with you.
I have three big takeaways from my conversation with Russ. Number one, share the gains. I appreciate that the values of company are important to Russ. When approaching a critical juncture around a private equity investment, he was hesitant at first. PE investments rarely benefit all employees. But when he learned that 10% of the upside or the gains on that investment would go back to the team, not just the executives, but to the entire team, he was in. Because this will allow every employee to build wealth and thus stay engaged. As Russ said, it makes them an owner in the company. If we win, you win. This mentally clinched the deal for Russ. Second, step back to grow. This is the lesson we come across time and time again. Russ was at the top of his game at a large company and a new opportunity, it comes along. The purview, much smaller. Skills required, different. On paper, some may have seen it as a downgrade. But Russ did the calculus around what he was giving up and what he would gain from jumping to an unknown S-curve. His instincts, they paid off. Three, don't fall victim to sunk costs. I was really impressed by Russ's story about the IPO. So much work, so much time, so much money goes into a process like that. They had invested so much, but the uncertainty in the world, it gave him pause. And at the last moment, he pulled the plug. Stop, it's not right, he said. At the time, he didn't know if he was making the right decision, but he didn't let the sunk costs of the process dictate the final outcome. That takes a lot of guts. For more on stepping back to grow, give a listen to Jason Jedlinski, episode 108. For more on modeling the behavior you want to see, you can give a listen to Melissa Smith, CEO of WEX, episode 98. And for more on Michelle McKenna, former CIO of the NFL, who now sits on Barbecue Guy's board, listen to episode 172. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your reviews. Thank you to our producer, Matt Silverman, audio engineer and editor, Whitney Jobe, and production assistant, Stephanie Brummel. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.